I found this episode somewhat surprising. So I'll go very quickly through the background of Poincaré's thinking, and then Zermelo, and then I'll say a few words about Boltzmann, and then we can open it to discussion. In 1889, 1 year before he published his recurrence result, Poincaré was already expressing doubts about the kinetic theory of gases, the whole program of a mechanical underpinning of heat. Do irreversible phenomena lend themselves to a mechanical explanation, asks Poincaré. Can one, for example, in representing the world as made up of atoms, and these atoms as undergoing attractions depending only on distances, explain why heat can never pass from a cold body to a hot body? I do not believe so. This is before his recurrence theorem. In 1892, the British physicist Tate wrote a rather scathing review in Nature of Poincaré's book called Thermodynamics. Now, I'm not sure whether you're aware of this, but Poincaré actually published a large book on his lectures on thermodynamics in 1892. Is there anything he didn't do? Anyway, Tate was saying, you know, it's really too bad that Poincaré never picks up on this theme, that the second law of thermodynamics ultimately only has probabilistic significance. It can't be strictly true. And in his reply, there was a certain amount of coming and going between the two authors. Obviously, Poincaré was stung by these criticisms. And he replies, one of his replies in Nature says, I have completely left aside a mechanical explanation of the principle of Clausius, which Monsieur Tate calls the true, i.e., the statistical basis of the second law of thermodynamics. He says in his book, I've completely left this aside. I have not spoken of this explanation, which, by the way, seems to me hardly satisfactory, because I wanted to stay completely outside of all molecular hypotheses, however ingenious they might be. And in particular, I passed over the kinetic theory of gases in silence. Well, actually, he didn't. Because if you look at his book, at the very, very end of his book, he mentions the idea of the kinetic theory of gases a la Maxwell. That's to say, remember what I mentioned? Maxwell says if you throw a tumblerful of molecules, of water molecules, into the sea, it's hard to get them back. Poincaré has a different metaphor. He says, suppose you start with a bag of wheat, and you put a grain of barley inside that bag, and then shake it. Try to get the grain of wheat back. A grain of barley back. And he says, there's clearly something irreversible happening here. But obviously, it's only statistical or probabilistic. And he says, well, maybe there's something to this, but I don't really like it. The tone of the end of his book is he admits there's this possibility, but he doesn't really like it. Now, in 1893, and this is the paper that he wrote for philosophers, everyone knows the mechanistic conception of the universe which has seduced so many good men. Are the hypotheses of the kinetic theory of gases legitimate, or are they self-consistent? I do not believe they are. There is no need for a long discussion in order to challenge an argument of which the premises are apparently in contradiction with the conclusion. Where one finds, in effect, reversibility in the premises, everything is time reversal invariant in the premises, and irreversibility in the conclusion. Now, he has a point. You can't get irreversibility out of assumptions that are strictly time reversal invariant. Of course, the devil is in the details. But finally, what I found the most interesting of all is in 1898, Poincaré published a paper on the stability of the solar system. Is the solar system stable? Now, by stable here, Poincaré really meant, do the states recur? Do the states of the solar, the planets, for example, when they're shifting around and everything, if you wait long enough, do they come back to the same state? Which means that there's a certain stability, as it were, in the structure of the dynamics of the solar system. He had published, 8 years earlier, a recurrence theorem. So what would you expect them to say? By the way, a translation of this paper was published in Nature. Well, you would have expected them to say, I, Henri Poincaré, in 1990, have proved beyond doubt that the planets in the solar system recur and therefore there's stability. He says exactly the opposite. Why does he say this? He says, look, if we look around the world, we see non-stable systems, unstable systems in this sense. We see everything decaying. We see evidence of the second law of thermodynamics everywhere we look. Is it the case that the celestial bodies provide a counterexample? Well, again, you would have thought it right from the beginning, yes, precisely because of his recurrence theorem. Are the movements of the heavenly bodies the only ones to escape? Now he says mathematical points. For example, when we write in this phase space the state of a gas, we're treating the gas molecules as points. They have sharply defined positions. They have sharply defined momenta. These are things that are beloved of mathematicians. Ironically, says the greatest mathematician of the time. He said, what is a planet? A planet is a large body that's not even elastic. It's composed of very complicated innards. It may even have a sea slopping around on the surface. It's interacting with other planets and the sun and other heavenly bodies that happen to find themselves in the solar system. And there are going to be tidal effects inside the body. We all know this is right. But what do tidal effects do? They create friction. What does friction do? It creates heat. Where does the heat go? It dissipates into empty space. Now, if you don't believe that heat has a mechanical underpinning, you are not going to apply the recurrence theorem to the planets. Poincaré asked the following question. Why does the face of the moon always, why is there a single face of the moon every time we look up to the moon? Why does it always show us the same face? That can't be a coincidence. The moon just happens to show one side of itself to us. Why is it, by the way, that the moons of Jupiter do the same thing to an observer on Jupiter? And Poincaré says, if you could imagine the moon forming in an original molten state, semi-liquid state, fluid state, all those tidal forces are going to make it lose energy because it's radiating heat, simply because of the tidal forces with relation to the Earth. And as it loses energy, its rotation with respect to the Earth becomes correlated with the Earth's rotation itself. So he says, if you think over the long period, a long enough period of time, all of the planets in the solar system, plus the sun, will form, as it were, a rigid body. I mean, they're not touching each other, but they will eventually, because of all these tidal effects, the frictional effects, the loss of heat into the environment, into empty space, if there's no friction with respect to space itself, and he wasn't so sure about this because he believed in the ether. At least he's on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, he believed in the ether. Poincaré is always very hard to pin down. But certainly, if there's no friction due to motion with respect to space, if they're moving in a pure vacuum, then all the planets eventually, and the sun, will form, as it were, a rigid configuration that's rotating with a single velocity, orbital velocity around a single axis. And that's where it'll stay forever. So the system is not recurring, despite his recurrence theorem. And it is very clear in this paper. He says, heat and the second law of thermodynamics is complementary. Quantum mechanicians here, please note. Complementary to the forces of mechanics. So he's saying quite explicitly, I do not believe you can reduce the notion of heat to motion, mechanical motion. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that Poincaré's objection to the kinetic theory of gases is far more than just saying, hey, Boltzmann has overdone it. Let's try to find some modified version of the H theorem, which will make things internally consistent, but will still give us some feeling for the second law of thermodynamics. What Poincaré is saying is the whole program is doomed. What about Zermelo? Now, Zermelo was not working with Poincaré. I can't remember who his supervisor was at this, during his PhD studies, but he was not in, he was not working with in Poincaré's orbit. Zermelo says, in his first paper in 1896, the first paper criticizing the H theorem, he says, there's no single-valued continuous function of the microstates that always increases for all initial states in some region of the phase space, no matter how small the region. So in other words, this is really related to this nice theorem he gives that actually doesn't even require the recurrence theorem. You just can't have an S function that's non-decreasing if the measure of the total space is finite. But of course, he also gives a nice variation of the proof. He gives a very nice proof of Poincaré's recurrence theorem. And he says, in 1896, when he's, you would have thought when you look at his first paper, that really all that he's doing is he's just setting up a contrast. He's saying, look, if you believe in the kinetic theory of gases, you have to get the H theorem right. You have to give some form of it that's not inconsistent with the time reversibility of the dynamics and furthermore the recurrence theorem. So it's not clear in his original paper that he's really doing, that he has anything like the kind of radical view that Poincaré has. But this is not true. He does have such a radical view. Look at his second reply to Boltzmann. Actually, it's his reply, Boltzmann replied to the Zermelo paper. In 1896, Zermelo replies to Boltzmann's reply. As for me, and I'm not alone in this opinion, I believe that a single principle, that's to say the second law of thermodynamics, summarizing an abundance of established experimental facts is more reliable than a mathematical theorem, the Poincaré recurrence theorem, which by its nature represents only a theory which can never be directly verified. Well, that's because the recurrence times are so long. I prefer to give up the theorem rather than the principle if the two are inconsistent. Thermodynamics first, then maybe mechanics, but you're not going to get anything like thermodynamics emerging out of mechanics. I have not been able to convince myself that Boltzmann's probability arguments are in fact able to dispel the doubts of a mechanical explanation of the irreversible processes based on Poincaré's theorem. Even if one renounces the strict irreversibility in favor of a merely empirical one. Notice the following sentence. Indeed, it is clear a priori that the probability concept has nothing to do with time, and therefore what cannot be used to deduce any conclusions about the direction of irreversible processes. Just bear that in mind for a moment. I'll come back to this after looking at Boltzmann. So to finish, Boltzmann, of course, had to say something in reply to both of these objections, the reversibility objection and the recurrence objection. And now in 1877, just a year after the original Loschmidt objection, Boltzmann says, I'm not using his words, but effectively he says, I didn't really mean it. I did not mean that the H theorem was an absolutely monotonically decreasing H result. I only meant it probabilistically. It can never be proved, says Boltzmann in 1895. This is part of the nature debate, but he's just repeating what he was saying in 1877. From the equations of motion alone, that the minimum function H must always decrease. Well, this is news, because if you read his 1872 paper, there's absolutely no indication that this isn't a definite result. It can only be deduced from the laws of probability that if the initial state is not specially arranged for a certain purpose, but haphazard governs freely, the probability that H decreases is always greater than it decreases. I beg your pardon, I got that wrong, haven't I? The probability that H decreases is always greater than it increases. What I have proved in my papers is as follows. It is extremely probable that H is very near to its minimum value. If it is greater, it may increase or decrease, but the probability that it decreases is always greater. Thus, if I obtain a certain value for dH by dt, this result does not hold for every time element dt. So he's admitting that the Stotzer-Lanzatz can't hold at all times, but it is only an average value. Now, I mentioned earlier that in the age theorem, even though he used the word probability for that S, that F distribution function, it's not really a probability. It's just counting. It's effectively counting the number of molecules whose velocity lie in a certain range. There's a finite number of them. Why do we introduce a probabilistic notion? By probability, I mean that type of thinking that goes from counting and leaves that behind to expecting. It's the reason that we introduce into statistical mechanics things like infinite ensembles or laws of subjective and logical inference, such as for something like the Jaynes approach. This is really what probability is all about, and this is where the real complication, conceptual complications arise. So when Boltzmann introduced a probabilistic variant on his H theorem, it was the moment when statistical mechanics became statistical mechanics. It's the moment that kinetic theory of gases became statistical mechanics in the full sense of the term. This is not always recognized in the literature. There's a moment in Boltzmann's thinking, and it postdates the H theorem, where the reasoning really becomes probabilistic. But now there's a problem. It is clear that in order to get around the recurrence result, the H theorem has to be weakened. And that's achieved by making it probabilistic. Boltzmann is not denying that systems recur. He's just saying that in the next reasonable period of time, you're not going to see the recurrence. And anyway, the system only has a certain very high probability of equilibrating. But what about the Loschmidt objection? Zermelo made the claim that introducing probabilities is not a time asymmetric notion. Just by making the H theorem probabilistic, why are you introducing an hour of time? Now, some of you will remember, have seen Boltzmann's famous diagram of the H theorem, the H curve. It looks something like here's the minimum value of H, which is achieved most of the time. So the system is mostly in equilibrium. But there are going to be fluctuations of H spontaneously occurring. And what Boltzmann is saying is that if you take a particular value of H, which is away from equilibrium, there's enormously, enormously higher probability of it going this way in the next instant than that way. But the trouble is, for every one of these values of H along this curve, there are also as many of those points as those points. But in these points, the entropy is decreasing. H is increasing. So where does the time asymmetry come from? So I think Zermelo raised an issue here that Boltzmann did not meet merely by introducing a probabilistic fluctuating H curve. He didn't really introduce an hour of time. So he didn't really meet the Loschmidt objection. Well, of course, the rest is a long story. How do we do it nowadays? What do we have to add to the Boltzmann picture to get a notion of the hour of time? But I'm going to leave that aside because it takes us out of this particular historical issue we've been looking at. So that's it. Thanks very much.
Could you say a few words on the quantum mechanical version?
Right.
So the reason why I also quite says that I always mention quantum mechanical states to have much more momentum, much more parameters than
classical. I'm going to give you a very, very, very rough picture of the proof. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do justice to the theorem. The theorem itself requires some non-trivial mathematics, but I'm going to give you just a sense as to how it works. There's this fundamental condition we impose that we have an isolated system, so we have some system S, and the energy spectrums in quantum mechanics, the energy spectrum is discrete. Now, that's going to be the analog of saying that the phase space has finite volume. If we allow for a continuous spectrum, it would be violating that corresponding assumption in the classical case. Okay. Now, think of an arbitrary state at time t equals 0. Well, we can always expand that state as a superposition of energy eigenstates, where now, if we have a Hamiltonian that's associated with the motion of the system, what does the Hamiltonian do to each one of these, acting on each one of these eigenstates? Well, each one of these eigenstates is a stable state, a stationary state. All that it does is pick up a phase factor, but the phase factor itself is cyclic, right? So every one of these guys is picking up a cyclic time-dependent phase factor. So you're going to be able to find the time, so there will exist a time, let's call it tau, such that the norm of the difference between psi of tau, which is just this thing acted upon by the Hamiltonian throughout this period of tau, minus psi of naught, is going to be less than epsilon, where epsilon is any number you like. If the energy spectrum is has equal spacing between, then it will be exact. So this is a quasi recurrence, but it's the standard Frank Array theorem is quasi.
I don't understand that you have four covalent states in general decay for periodic system, but at some point you might get them back.
Right. Anyway, that's the guts, as it were, of the recurrence theorem. It's being used nowadays quite a lot in discussions of quantum cosmology. Lenny Susskind is using this quite a lot. I mean, people are actually applying the quantum recurrence theorem to the cosmos. I'm not quite sure how you argue for the plausibility of a discrete energy spectrum. But what struck me, by the way, I don't know if people look at this theorem, but you don't have energy bounded from above.
But if you have, that means, doesn't that mean then the potential must go to infinity at those points, at some point? Or if you want to have, I mean, if you have the energy higher than the potential asymptotically, then you'll get continuous energy. So you need.
Yeah, if you want to have the energy
spectrum
together, that's
It needs to. You need to have a finite motion of your system, essentially, which is what.
Yeah.
Okay. If you take a free particle that spreads indefinitely, you know, so in which sense is going back to the initial?
Well, you have to put it in a box.
Right. So
you'd have to put it in a box.
The classical counterproductive theory is much stronger than this anyway. Here, there's restrictions which are.
Well, when you talk about an electron expanding into space, it's, you know, the wave function expands indefinitely spatially, say. If you're allowed to have infinite spatial extent, your phase space won't be finite. I think that's right, isn't it?
Because it only applies to finite.
So you could think of two particles just moving apart from each other.
But Poincaré is only applies to finite.
That's absolutely essential.
I don't know whether energy to be discrete means that
Earth is chaotic to begin with.
I think it's something weaker than that.
How do you define classical in the context of quantum mechanics?
If I see them as a quantization of some classical system, then if the energy spectrum is free after the old argument, the energy distinctness is given by the volume of the free space.
Yeah. Okay.
So, for this argument to apply, you need actually chaotic motion.
Well, but aren't you making the tail wag the dog? I mean, I'm taking quantum mechanics to be fundamental here.
Okay.
Yeah. Classical mechanics should seem to emerge out of that theory, not the other way around.
Yeah, that's true. In the semi-classical limit, you'll get something like that if you take that.
Yeah.
A question about the main point you were making. So, is it just to make sure I understand? Is it? Could you say that Boltzmann's change in position was something like the change in the way he claimed to apply this SZA condition? Yeah. So at first he's so the theorem is a mathematical thing holds as long as you assume that SZA. At first he said, well, I just assumed that, or he didn't even bother to say so. And then second, the next time around, he said, oh, well, I still stand by the theorem, but I think that SNA assumption is only true probabilistically.
Right.
So that's the way it works. So you can see this.
Right. Now, there's an interesting, this is, the nature of the reasoning isn't always understood. There's a very nice book on thermal physics by Emch and Chuang Liu, where they say, if you'd really understood the Stolzmann ansatz from the beginning, you would have seen it's probabilistic. But as I was saying before, the Stotzel ansatz is just a constraint on the possible state of a single gas. There's really nothing probabilistic about it. The question is, does it hold at all times? And as you say, what Boltzmann effectively came down to was the claim that it doesn't hold at all times. As it were, it holds on average. The chances are the next instance it will hold, or the chances are it will hold right now, but it can't hold at all times.
Always imagine arranging the particles such that it won't hold, just so that the two with high velocities will always collide, the two with low velocities will always collide, or something.
I mean, there's a nice example that Tahar gives. Tahar wrote a beautiful paper on the foundation of system mechanics, 1955, Reviews of Modern Physics, and he considers the following situation. Suppose, a number of simple mechanical models have been developed that express basically the guts of the H theorem. The Ehrenfest developed two of them. One of them was called the wind tree model. And it's a variation of what's called the Lorentz models, where you have some rigid objects in space. In the case that Tahar discusses, it's they're sort of heavy spherical molecules that are fixed in space. Suppose we have a given space where we have a random distribution of these heavy spherical molecules. Then we have you might call these trees. Then we have wind, which are point particles that are rushing through all the trees. They bounce elastically off the trees, but they don't change the position of the trees. The trees are fixed in space. Now, suppose we start in a state in which all of the incoming molecules are moving in the positive x direction. Okay? But their spatial distribution is random. Okay? That will be the analog of the Stotzel ansatz. The spatial distribution of all these wind molecules is random in space, apart from the fact they're all moving in one direction. What will happen when they hit the spheres, remember they're hitting them random points on the surface of the sphere, is that some of them, of course, will bounce back, some of them will bounce in that direction, some in that direction, some in that direction. In fact, all the way in all possible directions, we have these things distributed randomly in space, we have this random distribution of the wind molecules. What will be the state of the molecules after collisions? Total isotropy of of directions. All of the directions will be equally probable. I shouldn't have used the word probable. There will be an isotropic distribution of particles after the collisions. But now think of the time inverse. Even though you have an isotropic distribution of directions, if you time reverse it, it turns out that all of the wind molecules are going to hit one side of these molecules, and they're all going to come out in that direction. Now, in other words, they're pre-correlated. Those, even though the directions are isotropic, so it looks very disordered, in fact, they're all designed to hit one side of all the tree molecules, so that after the collision, they all end up in this single direction. Do you see the point? I'm just time reversing what we had before. So if the molecular collisions assumption is true going that way before the collision, it is certainly not true going that way. Okay? And the only way that they can both be true is when the system is in equilibrium. Okay, so you didn't start out with that state at all, but you had an equilibrium, you had an isotropic distribution of directions in the first place. But you can sort of see why Boltzmann couldn't quite give up the idea that, given that there's enough molecules, and you had enough time just preparing the system, he could never quite give up the idea that really, even in these special cases where all the molecules are coming in the same direction, they must be randomly distributed spatially. This notion of randomization before collision seemed so natural to Boltzmann. And even after he accepted that the thing was really only probabilistic, in the Nature debate, he gives us sort of a spurious argument as to why you're still going to get the Stotzer-Lanczos true over time by appealing to the diffuseness and the diluteness of the gas. He could never quite give up his attachment to the Stotzer-Lanczos. Should we call it a day?